Chapter 101. 'Tis hard and ill-paid task to order all things beforehand by the rule of our own security, as is well hinted by Machiavelli concerning Caesar Borgia, who, saith he, had thought of all that might occur on his father's death, and had provided against every evil chance save only one. It had never come into his mind that when his father died, his own death would quickly follow. Grandcourt's importance as a subject of this realm was of the grandly passive kind which consists in the inheritance of land. Political and social movements touched him only through the wire of his rental, and his most careful biographer need not have read upon Schleswig-Holstein, the policy of Bismarck, trade unions, household suffrage, or even the last commercial panic. He glanced over the best newspaper columns on these topics, and his views on them can hardly be said to have wanted breadth, since he embraced all Germans, all commercial men, and all voters liable to use the wrong kind of soap, under the general epithet of roots. But he took no action on these much agitated questions beyond looking from under his eyelids at any man who mentioned them, and retaining a silence which served to shake the opinions of timid thinkers. But Grandcourt, within his own sphere of interest, showed some of the qualities which have entered into triumphal diplomacy of the wildest continental sort. No movement of Gwendolen in relation to Durand escaped him. He would have denied that he was jealous, because jealousy would have implied some doubt of his own power to hinder what he had determined against. That his wife should have more inclination to another man's society than to his own would not pain him. What he required was that she should be as fully aware as she would have been of a locked handcuff, that her inclination was helpless to decide anything in contradiction with his resolve. However much of vacillating whim there might have been in his entrance on matrimony, there was no vacillating in his interpretation of the bond. He had not repented of his marriage. It had really brought more of aim into his life, new objects to exert his will upon, and he had not repented of his choice. His taste was fastidious, and Gwendolen satisfied it. He would not have liked a wife who had not received some elevation of rank from him, nor one who did not command admiration by her mien and beauty, nor one whose nails were not of the right shape, nor one the lobe of whose ear was at all too large and red, nor one who, even if her nails and ears were right, was at the same time a ninny, unable to make spirited answers. These requirements may not seem too exacting to refined contemporaries whose own ability to fall in love has been held in suspense for lack of indispensable details, but fewer perhaps may follow him in his contentment that his wife should be in a temper which would dispose her to fly out if she dared, and that she should have been urged into marrying him by other feelings than passionate attachment. Still, for those who prefer command to love, one does not see why the habit of mind should change precisely at the point of matrimony. Grandcourt did not feel that he had chosen the wrong wife, and having taken on himself the part of husband, he was not going in any way to be fooled, or allow himself to be seen in a light that could be regarded as pitiable. This was his state of mind, not jealousy. Still, his behavior in some respects was as like jealousy as yellow is to yellow, which color, we know, may be the effect of very different causes. He had come up to town earlier than usual, because he wished to be on the spot for legal consultation as to the arrangements of his will, the transference of mortgages, and that transaction with his uncle about the succession to Diplo, which the bait of ready money, adroitly dangled without importunity, had finally won him to agree upon. But another acceptable accompaniment of his being in town was the presentation of himself with the beautiful bride whom he had chosen to marry in spite of what other people might have expected of him. It is true that Grandcourt went about with the sense that he did not care a languid curse for anyone's admiration. But this state of not caring, just as much as desire, required its related object, namely, a world of admiring or envying spectators. For if you are fond of looking stonily at smiling persons, the persons must be, and they must smile, a rudimentary truth which is surely forgotten by those who complain of mankind as generally contemptible, since any other aspect of the race must disappoint the veracity of their contempt. Grand Court, in town for the first time with his wife, had his non-caring abstinence from curses enlarged and diversified by splendid receptions, by conspicuous rites and drives, by presentations of himself with her on all distinguished occasions. He wished her to be sought after. He liked that fellows should be eager to talk with her, and escort her within his observation. There was even a kind of lofty coquetry on her part that he would not have objected to. But what he did not like were her ways in relation to Deronda. After the musical party at Lady Malinger's, when Grandcourt had observed the dialogue on the settee as keenly as Hans had done, it was characteristic of him that he named Deronda for invitation along with the Malinger's, tenaciously avoiding the possible suggestion to anybody concerned that Deronda's presence or absence could be of the least importance to him. And he made no direct observation to Gwendolyn on her behavior that evening, lest the expression of his disgust should be a little too strong to satisfy his own pride. But a few days afterward he remarked, without being careful of the apropos, "Nothing makes a woman more of a gawky than looking out after people and showing tempers in public. A woman ought to have good manners, else it's intolerable to appear with her." Gwendolyn made the expected application, and was not without alarm at the notion of being a gawky. For she too, with her melancholy distaste for things, preferred that her distaste should include admirers. But the sense of overhanging rebuke only intensified the strain of expectation toward any meeting with Deronda. The novelty and excitement of her town life was like the hurry and constant change of foreign travel. Whatever might be the inward despondency, there was a program to be fulfilled, not without gratification to many-sided self. But, as always happens with a deep interest, the comparatively rare occasions on which she could exchange any words with Deronda had a diffusive effect in her consciousness, magnifying their communication with each other, and therefore enlarging the place she imagined it to have in his mind. How could Deronda help this? He certainly did not avoid her. Rather, he wished to convince her by every delicate indirect means that her confidence in him had not been indiscreet, since it had not lowered his respect. Moreover, he liked being near her. How could it be otherwise? She was something more than a problem. She was a lovely woman, for the turn of whose mind and fate he had a care which, however futile it might be, kept soliciting him as a responsibility, perhaps all the more that, when he dared to think of his own future, he saw it lying far away from this splendid sad-hearted creature, who, because he had once been impelled to arrest her attention momentarily, as he might have seized her arm with warning, to hinder her from stepping where there was danger, had turned to him with a beseeching, persistent need. One instance in which Grandcourt stimulated a feeling in Gwendolyn that he would have liked to suppress without seeming to care about it had relation to Mira. Gwendolyn's inclination lingered over the project of the singing lessons as a sort of obedience to Deronda's advice, but day followed day with that want of perceived leisure which belongs to lives where there is no work to mark off intervals, and the continual liability to Grandcourt's presence and surveillance seemed to flatten every effort to the level of the boredom which his manner expressed. His negative mind was as diffusive as fog, clinging to all objects, and spoiling all contact. But one morning when they were breakfasting, Gwendolyn, in a recurrent fit of determination to exercise the old spirit, said, "Dallying prettily over her prawns without eating them, I think of making myself accomplished while we are in town, and having singing lessons." "Why?" said Grandcourt, languidly. "Why?" echoed Gwendolyn, playing at sauciness. "Because I can't eat pate de foie gras to make me sleepy, and I can't smoke, and I can't go to the club, to make me like to come away again. I want a variety of NUI. What would be the most convenient time when you are busy with your lawyers and people for me to have lessons from that little Jewess whose singing is getting all the rage? Whenever you like, said Grand Court, pushing away his plate and leaning back in his chair while he looked at her with his most lizard-like expression and played with the ears of the tiny spaniel on his lap. Gwendolyn had taken a dislike to the dogs because they fawned on him. Then he said, languidly, I don't see why a lady should sing. Amateurs make fools of themselves. A lady can't risk herself in that way in company. And one doesn't want to hear squalling in private. I like frankness. That seems to me a husband's great charm, said Gwendolyn, with her little upward movement of her chin, as she turned her eyes away from his, and lifting a prawn before her, looked at the boiled ingenuousness of its eyes as preferable to the lizard's. Be but, she added, having devoured her mortification, I suppose you don't object to Miss Lapidus singing at our party on the 4th? I thought of engaging her. Lady Brackenshaw had her, you know. And the Raymonds, who are very particular about their music. And Mr. Deronda, who is a musician himself and a first-rate judge, says there is no singing in such good taste as hers for a drawing room. I think his opinion is an authority. She meant to sling a small stone at her husband in that way. It's very indecent of Deronda to go about praising that girl, said Grandcourt in a tone of indifference. Indecent! Exclaimed Gwendolyn, reddening, and looking at him again, overcome by startled wonder, and unable to reflect on the probable falsity of the phrase, oh, go about praising. Yes, and especially when she is patronized by Lady Malinger. He ought to hold his tongue about her. Men can see what is his relation to her. Men who judge of others by themselves, said Gwendolyn, turning white after her redness, and immediately smitten with a dread of her own words. Of course. And a woman should take their judgment else she is likely to run her head into the wrong place, said Grandcourt, conscious of using pincers on that white creature. I suppose you take Deronda for a saint. Oh dear no, said Gwendolyn, summoning desperately her almost miraculous power of self-control, and speaking in a high, hard tone. Oh, only a little less of a monster. She rose, pushed her chair away without hurry, and walked out of the room with something like the care of a man who is afraid of showing that he has taken more wine than usual. She turned the keys inside her dressing room doors, and sat down for some time looking pale and quiet as when she was leaving the breakfast room. Even in the moments after reading the poisonous letter, he had hardly had more cruel sensations than now, for emotion was at the acute point where it is not distinguishable from sensation. Deronda, unlike what he had believed him to be, was an image which affected her as a hideous apparition would have done, quite apart from the way in which it was produced. It had taken hold of her as pain, before she could consider whether it were fiction or truth, and further to hinder her power of resistance came the sudden perception, how very slight were the grounds of her faith in Deronda, how little she knew of his life, how childish he had been in her confidence. His rebukes and his severity to her began to seem odious, along with all the poetry and lofty doctrine in the world, whatever it might be, and the grave beauty of his face seemed the most unpleasant mask that the common habits of men could put on. All this went on in her with the rapidity of a sick dream, and her start into resistance was very much like a waking. Suddenly from out the gray somber morning there came a stream of sunshine, wrapping her in warmth and light, where she sat in stony stillness. She moved gently, and looked round her. There was a world outside this bad dream, and the dream proved nothing. She rose, stretching her arms upward, and clasping her hands with her habitual attitude, when she was seeking relief from oppressive feeling, and walked about the room in this flood of sunbeams. It is not true. What does it matter, whether he believes it or not? This is what she repeated to herself, but this was not her faith come back again. It was only the desperate cry of faith, finding suffocation intolerable. And how could she go on through the day in this state? With one of her impetuous alternations, her imagination flew to wild actions by which she would convince herself of what she wished. She would go to Lady Malinger and question her about Mira. She would write to Deronda, and upbraid him with making the world all false, and wicked and hopeless to her. To him, she dared pour out all the bitter indignation of her heart. No, she would go to Mira. This last form taken by her need was more definitely practicable, and quickly became imperious. No matter what came of it. As he had the pretext of asking Mira to sing at her party on the 4th. What was she going to say beside? How satisfy? She did not foresee, she could not wait to foresee. If that idea which was maddening her had been a living thing, she would have wanted to throttle it without waiting to foresee what would come of the act. She rang her bell and asked if Mr. Grandcourt were gone out. Finding that he was, she ordered the carriage and began to dress for the drive. Then she went down and walked about the large drawing room like an imprisoned dumb creature, not recognizing herself in the glass panels, not noting any object around her in the painted gilded prison. Her husband would probably find out where as he had been and punish her in some way or other. No matter, she could neither desire nor fear anything just now but the assurance that as he had not been deluding herself in her trust. She was provided with Mira's address. Soon she was on the way with all the fine equipage necessary to carry about her poor uneasy heart, depending in its palpitations on some answer or other to questioning which she did not know how she should put. She was as heedless of what happened before she found that Miss Lapidus was at home as one is of lobbies and passages on the way to a court of justice, heedless of everything till she was in a room where there were folding doors and she heard Deronda's voice behind it. Doubtless the identification was helped by forecast, but she was as certain of it as if as he had seen him. She was frightened at her own agitation, and began to unbutton her gloves, that she might button them again, and bite her lips over the pretended difficulty, while the door opened, and Mira presented herself with perfect quietude, and a sweet smile of recognition. There was relief in the sight of her face, and Gwendolyn was able to smile in return, while she put out her hand in silence. And as she seated herself, all the while hearing the voice, she felt some reflux of energy in the confused sense that the truth could not be anything that she dreaded. Mira drew her chair very near, as if she felt that the sound of the conversation should be subdued, and looked at her visitor with placid expectation, while Gwendolyn began in a low tone, with something that seemed like bashfulness. Perhaps you wonder to see me, perhaps I ought to have written, but I wish to make a particular request. I am glad to see you instead of having a letter, said Mira, wondering at the changed expression and manner of the Andic Duchess, as Hans had taught her to call Gwendolyn. The rich color and the calmness of her own face were in strong contrast with the pale agitated beauty under the plumed hat. I thought, Gwendolyn went on, tea least I hoped, you would not object to sing at our house on the 4th in the evening at a party like Lady Brackenshaw's. I should be so much obliged. I shall be very happy to sing for you. At 10? Said Mira, while Gwendolyn seemed to get more instead of less embarrassed. At 10, please, she answered, then paused, and felt that as he had nothing more to say, she could not go. It was impossible to rise and say goodbye. Deronda's voice was in her ears. She must say it, she could contrive no other sentence. Mr. Deronda's in the next room. Yes, said Mira, in her former tone. He is reading Hebrew with my brother. You have a brother? Said Gwendolyn, who had heard this from Lady Malinger, but had not minded it then. Yes, a dear brother who is ill-consumptive, and Mr. Deronda is the best of friends to him, as he has been to me, said Mira, with the impulse that will not let us pass the mention of a precious person indifferently. Tell me, said Gwendolyn, putting her hand on Mira's, and speaking hardly above a whisper, tell me the truth. You are sure he is quite good. You know no evil of him. Any Evil That People Say of Him Is. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.